This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Ringgit and Cents on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Gold is the hedge as old as time. It's widely regarded as a store of value, and it traditionally behaves inverse to the stock market. However, in recent times, we've seen both stocks and gold go up together. So today on the show, I explore the differences between investing in gold and in stocks in this unprecedented and uncertain time. To help me with this, I'm speaking with Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation. Rajan, welcome back to the show.
Roshan, hi. It's great to be back.
Always good to have you on the show, Rajan. Now, before we get into the reasons why stocks and gold are behaving similarly right now, I'd like to establish the key differences between stocks and gold overall. First thing, what gives stocks their value?
That's a really good question. And right now, at a time when many stock markets are basically rising on a wave of exuberance and pretty much free money printed by central banks around the world, a lot of people who have never invested in the stock market ever have been sucked into the allure. And one of the biggest dangers is that many of them seem to think that it is actually simply a momentum play. One of the best descriptions of the stock market that I've ever come across is originally from Warren Buffett's Sifu, his mentor, Benjamin Graham. And Benjamin Graham is the one who said that in the short run, the stock market is a voting machine. But in the long run, the stock market is a weighing machine. And right now, the exuberance that we are seeing in the face of immense cratering of the real economies around the world, a lot of it is irrational. And it is simply because too many people are voting with their money and with their newly opened stock accounts. So certainly in Malaysia, we're seeing a resurgence of retail interest. I sincerely hope that retail interest continues to build. But since many of these people are simply chasing after the glove makers, you know what's going to happen, right? Eventually, we're going to get this pandemic under control. So at some stage, when the global demand starts to ease, earnings numbers are going to start plateauing, maybe not dipping, but plateauing. And once that happens, people will be shifting their interest elsewhere. So I expect stock markets to readjust downward at some stage, but when it happens, I don't know. So the stock market's aggregate valuation is the cumulative valuation of all the stocks that are listed on it. And for a single company, the question you got to ask yourself is this entire company worth the total market capitalization of that company? Let's just use a generic hypothetical, okay? Let's say we've got ABC Berhad, and let's say with the current run-up in the market, its current valuation, when you take the current price multiplied by the number of shares outstanding, is say 10 billion ringgit, so less than 2.5 billion US dollars. So 10 billion ringgit. What that means, what that tells us is if someone could come along, maybe someone like Buffett, who can write a single check that will cover 10 billion ringgit, that's what you would need to pay to buy the entire company. And ultimately, what gives a company its valuation is its earnings. And here specifically, we're talking about net profit. If you then divide that by the number of outstanding common shares, you get your earnings per share. And obviously, the way things work in the stock market, what you have is price per share. So when you talk about a PE ratio, it is actually your price per share divided by your earnings per share, which is exactly the same as, for those who are mathematically inclined, it's exactly the same as the market capitalization divided by the aggregate net profit that gives you your PE ratio. So the truth is, it's earnings.
So the stock essentially brings in money, right? It's a cash flow producing asset and you want it to produce a net profit. And that's why you start a business, right? End of the day, a stock is a piece of ownership of a much larger business. And if you started your own business, you'd want it to bring in profit. Now, unlike stocks, gold produces no cash flow or potential income. So why do we care so much about this asset?
One of the most interesting things about gold is mankind's love affair with the precious metal. The little bit of reading that I've done on it suggests that gold has been used as jewelry and sometimes as money, specifically commodity money, for at least 5,000 years. I know that the ancient Egyptians were mining for gold long before 2000 BC. So the allure of gold is the allure of gold. Now, I understand that that's a circular argument, but that really is the truth. And in a world where we have a disturbingly tweeting president, in a world with at least century-long unprecedented pandemic, in a world of uncertainty, in a world in ecological crisis, people are constantly looking for something safe. So from an investment perspective, gold is loved by mankind and it is deemed to be a safe haven. People say asset class. I tend to think of it more as an asset segment under alternative investments. Alternative investments actually are a catch-all phrase for, I think, six different subcategories. And some of those, I'm not sure if I can remember them all, but some of those would be foreign currency, derivatives, private equity, hedge funds, structured products, but my favorite actually would be commodities. So yes, I did remember all six. And so within those, so asset class and then asset sector, that's the way I think of it anyway, asset segment, doesn't really matter. And then, so you got commodities. And then inside commodities represent the very stuff of life. Our entire civilization is actually built upon commodities. You know, without commodities, our skyscrapers can't go up. Without commodities, we've got no rice on our plates. There's no wheat. There's no cotton. Civilization rises and falls on the availability of commodities. And that's one of the reasons why, in the long run, I'm actually very, very optimistic about commodities. Now, within the commodity space, you've got hard commodities and soft commodities. In general, hard commodities are dug out of the ground by miners, and soft commodities are grown by farmers. Obviously, precious metals are dug out of the ground, so they come under hard commodities. The most common four precious metals that people talk about investing in are gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. Now, of the four precious metals, gold is the one with magical allure. From a usability perspective, I prefer silver, because silver is an industrial metal. But for a long time, gold has been mainly, it's there to make us feel good. I believe that based on current consumption numbers, 50% of all the gold that is produced in any particular year goes into jewelry. 40% goes into investments, you know, when you and I take a gold position. And only 10% goes into industrial usage. What I have learned very recently is that the industrial uses of gold may actually increase. And if that's true, then my interest in gold will actually grow. From an investment perspective, I don't really mind whether my clients want to take a broad-based commodity slice or a narrower precious metal slice or an even narrower gold slice. I don't really mind. But I would not have too much of it in any particular portfolio.
Basically, gold is a commodity, but what we've done is that we've also made it a store of value for a lot of investors. Whenever the quantitative easing kicks in, there's a bit of more attention given to gold because of the fact that it's supposedly there's a limited supply of gold. You can't print out more gold, right? There's a limited amount of it. So there, it has that dual role, but it's not the most usable of the commodities or the precious metals in the industrial world or the consumption world. But it still has that allure societally or culturally as that store of value, and that really helps it keep in the minds of the of people, really.
Absolutely. And there is another factor that I think will play a big role in gold's strength in the years to come. Right now, China is the most populous nation on earth. That will probably change in the next maybe 10 or 15 years, and India will rise to the fore. And if you know anything about our forebears, as it were, or ethnically people like you and me, culturally, we love gold. So I would imagine with more and more Indians on the planet, the usage of gold in jewelry is also going to go up. And then if at the same time you have a slight increase in industrial usage, that's very, very good.
I'm speaking with Rajan Devadasan, licensed financial planner with Manulife Investment Management Malaysia Berhad. Up next, why have stocks and gold broken their traditional relationship? Keep it here to Ringgit and Sense to find out. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Ringgit and Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Today, I'm speaking with Rajan Devadasan, CEO of RD Wealth Creation, and we're talking about stocks and gold. So traditionally, gold is considered a hedge against stocks in that they generally move in different directions based on the macroeconomic conditions. But we're not seeing that right now. Why is that so, Rajan?
If you have more and more money being printed out of thin air by central banks. The four most important central banks of the world are the US Federal Reserve, the ECB, the European Central Bank, the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, and the BOE, the Bank of England. And every time, certainly in the last 12 years, every time we run into a little bit of a road bump, the solution is monetary policy, drop interest rates, print money. And so, thankfully, it's not just printing money out of thin air. You're actually printing money and you're creating a corresponding bond position, a sovereign bond position to balance it out. So what's happening is the level of debt worldwide is skyrocketing, much of it sovereign debt. The amount of paper that there is, paper money, is also skyrocketing. And if you have, let's say you have over a... Hypothetically, over a one-year period, you have the money supply grow by 100%. But the supply of goods and services over 1 year only grows by 5 percentage points. So what's going to happen is you've got more and more money chasing after relatively fewer goods. Obviously, the price of goods will be bid up. And then what will happen is that prices will skyrocket. So with all this printing, people have been expecting hyperinflation for an incredibly long time. But you've noticed how it hasn't happened? This is actually quite an amazing situation. Why hasn't there been hyperinflation at retail level? And I don't have all the answers, but my own reading, my own thinking on the subject suggests that you have a situation where artificial intelligence, robotics, actually allows for increased efficiencies. And as the productivity of an individual country continues to rise, then the pressure for inflation is not so great. Nonetheless, you still end up with a lot of excess money, and we're still missing. It's a bit of a mystery. It's like, where on earth is this inflation that we're expecting? And if you stop and you think about the world as a whole, one, we should be very grateful that we don't have hyperinflation at ground level in the pasar or in the pasar malam or whatever else. Although in a Malaysian context, if you go to the market and you try and buy vegetables or you try and buy fish, you'll find that prices are creeping up, but nowhere near the rate of hyperinflative price increases. What's been happening in terms of hyperinflation is that the money has been flowing into the investment markets. Where exactly? The stock market and the certain commodity markets, and certainly in the gold market. And this actually is why I think we have this incredibly weird situation where under normal circumstances, stocks go up, gold comes down, stocks come down, gold comes up. Right now, we have a situation of everything moving in the same direction and yay, it's going up. For now, the day of reckoning will come. So preparation is very, very important. And if you want, I'll talk about how we can prepare. But that's my view. Basically, we're seeing inflation, we're seeing hyperinflation, but it's in the asset classes, it's in the investment assets.
So Rajan, with all that in mind, do you think gold has lost its luster as a hedge asset in this ultra low rate environment that we're seeing?
Not at all. Not at all. I'm very sure that gold's price is going to oscillate up and down as it always does. But I think as long as central banks around the world continue to figure out desperately some way to reduce their reliance on US treasuries, particularly because America is becoming increasingly unfriendly with the rest of the world, I think lots of different steps need to be taken. And certainly central banks accumulating gold reserves, that would be part of it. So there will be very, very strong demand. I think the India effect, like I mentioned, will also provide exposure. But, you know, you could get the cycle wrong. You could actually end up on the wrong end of the gold cycle. You could see a 10-year, 20-year slump. But I don't see that as a bad thing, because if it's a slump, it means that gold prices will be low. And in the long run, if you take the view that you're going to be an investor for 30 years or 40 years or whatever else, and some of your listeners are so young, they may be investing for 50 years, then just having a proper dollar cost averaging program. Now, you and I have spoken about the five criteria of dollar cost averaging many times on this show over several years. Let me just recap. The five criteria, in my book at least, when you want dollar cost averaging to work are, number one, you must buy a high quality asset. Do not buy rubbish. Number two, you must buy an asset that fluctuates in price. Don't buy something like a fixed deposit or whatever else where the price is very steady. I'm not saying don't put money in FDs, okay? Even though interest rates are coming down, I continue to keep some of my money in fixed deposits, particularly as a way of ring fencing my tax money so that when the money is required, it is there and I pay the IRB on time or preferably early. But in general, dollar cost averaging, buy a high quality asset, one that fluctuates in price. And then criteria 3, 4, and 5 are buy equal ringgit amounts or dollar amounts or whatever at equal intervals, maybe once a month, once in 3 months. And number 5 is regardless of market conditions. And you think about it, gold fulfills all of those requirements, certainly the first two, high quality asset that fluctuates in price. Now, back in, I think it was August 2011, gold hit an all-time high, I think, of $1,919.17 US, if I'm remembering correctly. And, you know, gold can slump, and right now it's, I think, above 1,800. I wouldn't be surprised if over the next 10 years, gold pretty much fluctuates between $1,000 an ounce and $3,000 an ounce. But, you know, if the number of people, certainly between now and the year 2064, when the most recent article says that humanity's numbers will peak and then start to come down, the new projections suggest that by 2100, we'll be down to 8.8 billion people. So, you know, considering the kind of stuff that I talk about and write about all the time, this was major. But for those of us who are going to be excitedly and excitingly invested over the next 44 years, the primary trend that we must look at is the demographic trend. Over the next 40 years, between 2020 and 2064, humanity's numbers will rise. As we begin to see the plateauing, so maybe around about, say from about maybe 2055 or so, as we begin to see the end in sight from growth, I think, you know, people, the investment markets are going to start readjusting. But 2055 is 35 years away. For the vast majority of us, now is the time for us to ride this demographic wave. And there are many things that can be done. I advocate for well-diversified portfolios that people invest in cash, even though yields are terrible because you want some level of safety, that they invest in fixed income, meaning bonds, because in general, one would assume interest rates will come down more than going up. And bonds give you significantly better returns in cash. Always, always, always invest in equities because businesses are the creators of value. And then investment real estate. I personally have had a really, really bad run when it comes to physical real estate. But many of my friends, many of my clients have done very, very well. But I personally prefer REITs, direct REITs and listed REITs. We've spoken about that as well. And also invest in AI, alternative investments. And as I have mentioned, of the 6 subcategories under AI, my favorite is commodities. Now, does that mean that I would put all my money, my commodity money into gold? Probably not. Certainly for myself and for my clients, I use a global commodity fund. Then we just let the fund manager figure out which commodities to buy and which ones to sell. But some people may feel that they don't want broad commodities. What they want is precious metals. And others may say they don't even just want precious metals in general. They want gold specifically. So textbook suggests that we should have about 5% of our money in commodities. That's a textbook approach. Many years ago, when I was really beginning to get very worried about central banks printing more and more and more money, I took the view that, you know, I think I think gold's really going to start flying as compensatory price action. And so I began to build up a gold position for a while on a dollar cost averaging basis. On top of that, I also took the view that I'm going to move from textbook 5%, and I personally will basically aim for a 7 percentage point exposure. So for people who are listening, who are wondering, you know, I want to invest in commodities, my recommendation is that they have maybe 7% of commodities, or if they like precious metals, 7% precious metals. If they just want gold, 7% gold.
On that note, Rajan, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's been so much fun, Roshan. I hope we get to do it again soon, very soon.
I've been speaking with Rajan Devadasan, licensed financial planner with Manulife Investment Management Malaysia Berhad. And remember, with all possible investments and strategies, you have to do your own homework into the asset, keeping in mind your risk profile and financial goals in mind. Now, you've been listening to Ringgit & Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kanasin for BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.